Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty, and we are so delighted to be here in Detroit, live at the Charles H. Wright Museum of African American History. And so happy to welcome our beautiful audience. Thank you all so much for being with us for this show. It's so fun for us because we get to see you, and it makes such a wonderful difference. Happy you're here. And we got today's show off on a wonderful note. That was the music of the Marcus Elliott Quartet. We're all feeling so chill and happy now with that beautiful music. And the Marcus Elliott Quartet will be gracing us with their music all throughout today's show. On the show today, we're going to explore questions about Detroit's identity, the past, the present, and the future. We're going to dig in and see whether the big developments in downtown Detroit and Midtown and Corktown are being felt in Detroit's neighborhoods. But now to my first guest. She's a key player in one of the most critical debates that Michigan faces, how to keep the doors open for over 45,000 Detroit public school students. She's the daughter of a teacher and a school librarian, a graduate of Detroit Public Schools, a longtime Detroit teacher and administrator, and now the interim superintendent of the Detroit Public School System, Alicia Merriweather. Welcome to Stateside. So good to have you with us.
Thank you.
As the state senate and the state house work in Lansing and hammer out the differences in their respective funding packages, I'm wondering, what are your thoughts as this budget crisis is before you now that you're in the superintendent's office? Is there a way out, do you see?
Well, let's start with my thoughts. First of all, as the pictures are kind of panning across the back, those are my thoughts. My thoughts are around the students of Detroit Public Schools. And really, to think about a future without Detroit Public Schools is just an unthinkable future. I just cannot even imagine that we're having this conversation. 46,000 plus students are impacted by the decisions that are being made in Lansing right now. And obviously, today's a school day. All of our kids are in school, our teachers are in school, and we're having a great day of teaching and learning. And we want to make sure that that continues. I think there is hope. I think people are learning more and more about what the real issues are. I'm hopeful that the Senate and the House can come to an agreement. Certainly right now, they're not very close. But what I'm really, really hopeful about is that people, what they agree about is that Detroit kids are worth investing in. And I feel like we're doing a better job of helping people understand that story. And yesterday we just announced 12 new proposals for schools. And to be clear, these are proposals that were developed by current teachers and administrators through our internal proposal process. And so these are people who have had ideas about how to make school better. And they submitted their proposals. I think we had about 36 proposals from the inside. They were vetted. 18 were selected to move to the larger process, and then 12 were ultimately chosen to move forward.
And give us an idea of these programs. As you say, they're coming from the people right there.
They're coming from within. And so an idea of Montessori, so a free public Montessori. It's a Detroit public school, an Arabic immersion technology school, a school over at Priest that would actually address an issue that's been a big problem at Priest, which is students who are between the ages of 14 to 18 who are speaking no English pretty much, and obviously they cannot enter into a high school. And so the program would be a class that's opened up specifically for that purpose, an overage ELL classroom that they believe if they implement the programming with fidelity, that within 2 years, the students would be able to enter into high school and be successful coming out with either a diploma, hopefully a diploma or a GED, either way. Some other things that are on the table, expansion of programming at AL Homes in terms of blended learning and digital learning, all kinds of, it's creative, on our website,
creative
innovation.
Ideas.
Innovation is the key. And what I said yesterday, and I'll say it again, I feel like those ideas should provide further evidence of why Detroit Public Schools is worth investing in at this time. And two things to think about. The proposals came from the inside, which means we're utilizing intellect and capacity that we already have. And secondly, we're talking about repurposing and reusing buildings that we already own. And so we're talking about maximizing both our human capital and our actual assets to the best of our abilities and really being more creative about how we handle teaching and learning.
Let's talk about the mountain that you need to climb. And you've been teaching in Detroit or working in administration mm-hmm. since before the state came in and took over. And I'm wondering, with that perspective of having seen before and now all these years since, State Management. You're interim superintendent. You're working with the latest manager, John Stephen Rhodes. What do you think the two of you can do to break this cycle of failure that has been a problem till now?
Well, what I'm hopeful about, actually, is, first of all, Judge Rhodes has been on record several times as really clearly outlining the financial situation for Detroit Public Schools, that bankruptcy is not an option. It does not make sense in terms of the type of debt that Detroit Public Schools has. What does make sense, and what I'm hopeful about breaking this cycle, is that the legislature will see the sense in paying off the debt that was accumulated under state management, and then also looking at ways to invest in Detroit Public Schools moving forward. So we're talking about addressing the debt, and first and foremost. So the House and Senate do agree on that.
Yes.
The issue where there's a diversion is how much more money beyond that. And so I want to be clear that paying off the debt is really non-negotiable. That in order for Detroit Public Schools to move forward, that has to happen. And it is the state's responsibility to help us do that. Beyond that, the investment to help us move forward is the critical conversation. Mm-hmm. And right now, the debate is around the $200 million. And Judge and I are both on record as saying $200 million is basically the bare minimum. And for people who have a hard time, I think all of us who think about money, when you think about $200 million, that's a lot of money. But when you think about 93 buildings, 97 schools, and you've seen on the news the issues with our facilities, you could use $200 million today for just that purpose. Yeah. And so to argue about $200 million being too much is really a debate I don't understand either. So we are really looking at that additional footing to invest in facilities, innovative programs, technology, safety, and things that move Detroit Public Schools forward.
I hope we will continue to be able to converse with you on stateside as this process evolves, because it was great to have you with us today.
Thank
Alicia Merriweather, interim superintendent of Detroit's Public Schools, we want to thank you for being with us on stateside. It was great to have you here.
Thank you. I'll come back anytime. Thank you.
Dearborn has become a flashpoint for many people in America. Anti-Islam protesters carrying weapons have rallied in the city. The Arab American National Museum has responded by inviting people to better understand the city through food. Our Lester Graham recently joined a group going on a food tour called Yalla Eat.
Well, let's start with the first cultural hurdle. What does Yalla Eat mean?
Yalla means, like, let's go, kind of hurry up. It's like a fun phrase, almost like, come on, let's go, you know.
That's David Surio. He's an educator and public program specialist at the Arab American National Museum. There are so many wrong things being reported about Dearborn, that it enforces Sharia law, that it's not safe to walk the streets. Surio says the Arab American community in Dearborn wanted to show people that's just not true, in an inviting way.
So one of the goals with Yalla Eat is to kind of get rid of those stereotypes and to show people the neighborhood, our community that we live in, that's just like every other community that has, you know, various ethnic groups. I mean, there are a lot of Arab Americans in Dearborn, but there are a lot of other groups that have historically been here and continue to live in Dearborn. And again, it also kind of sheds stereotypes on who Arab Americans are in general. People go walking into the businesses and meeting the business owners and sampling food. It helps to really break down a lot of the stereotypes that people may have.
Once owned by maybe either immigrants themselves who are sort of serving the dishes that they or their families grew up with back home.
On Michigan Avenue, the tour guide, Camelia Youssef, tells the group about Dearborn's restaurants and businesses, along with a little history about Dearborn between each stop at Lebanese, Yemeni, and other restaurants serving Arab world cuisines. It includes a visit to a grocery store, samples at restaurants, and a coffee shop featuring desserts.
I think for a lot of the attendees of the Yalla Eat tours, food becomes a way to talk about culture without talking about all of the other things that feel uncomfortable to talk about when we're thinking about Arab and Muslim American experiences.
She says some attendees are surprised to learn that many Arab Americans are Christian or secular, not just Muslim. Most of today's group was made up of white people of European descent. That's fairly typical of these tour groups. On the way to the next stop for a sample of food, Catherine Seipert and Matt McHenry explained what they were getting out of the experience.
Well, I love it because these are places that I really wouldn't have even known about or probably even noticed if they weren't being pointed out to me. So I think the point of the tour that way is really cool, and also just as like a time of cultural exploration where you can maybe go outside of your comfort zone or try something like Yemeni food, which I've never had and didn't know I could access. Having this moment where I can has been really fascinating for me.
Do you think food's a good way to communicate culture?
It's fantastic, I think, because it's one of the few things that it transcends all lines and backgrounds. If you have a good plate of food and you're open to trying it, you'll be surprised what you like and how easy it is to relate to another completely different culture just through sharing a plate of food that you both can enjoy.
Some of the tour group said they simply wanted to find out about the food. But at almost every stop, there were questions about culture, about world politics and domestic politics, and how Dearborn residents felt about the anti-Islamic sentiments in the country. Camelia Youssef says the Yala'eet tours are a small, polite exchange and a way to better understand a little bit more about Dearborn and its residents.
Food is always one of the ways that we not only preserve our culture and sort of continue to practice it while being here in this country, but this is also one of the ways that we invite other people into our spaces.
For Stateside, I'm Lester Graham.
Coming up, what is Detroit's identity? If Detroit was known worldwide last century is the Motor City, what should its identity be in the 21st century? And does it matter? That's after the Marcus Elliott Quartet takes us to the news break. And, of course, you are listening to Stateside live from the Charles H. Wright Museum of African American History. To Stateside. Welcome back to Stateside on Michigan Radio. I'm Cynthia Canty, broadcasting live from the Charles H. Wright Museum of African American History in Detroit today. The Marcus Elliott Quartet providing us with wonderful music, a great audience here. So happy to have you with us. Every Thursday on our Next Idea segment, we look at the innovations and we look at the new ideas that could reshape Michigan. Today, we want to explore Detroit's brand. Brooklyn, known as a hipster haven, Silicon Valley, known for tech innovation, and other Rust Belt cities like Cleveland, which has embraced healthcare, Pittsburgh with the clean tech industry and their foodie scene, they've been trying to reinvent themselves. So does Detroit need an identity of its own? With us now to talk about this is Sandy Barua, president and CEO of the Detroit Regional Chamber. So great to have you with us, Sandy.
Thank you, Cynthia. Nice to be here.
And also with us, Jeff DeGraff, innovation expert at U of M's Ross School of Business and our partner on The Next Idea. As always, welcome, Jeff. Good to
Thank
see you.
You
here.
Thank you.
Sandy, in the 20th century, as we all know, Detroit was known the world over as the Motor City. What do you see as Detroit's post-bankruptcy identity? Does it have one yet?
So, you know, Detroit was known as the Motor City. We were also known as Motown. So I think it's really important that whatever Detroit is known for next begins with the letter M. Because if nothing else, we need consistency. But fortunately, that's what's happening. And it's mobility. And here's what I mean by that. The mobility industry is transforming before our very eyes in a substantial and meaningful way that's going to transform society as we know it, and it's going to transform the industries that we traditionally think about as automotive industries. So we think of transportation today as a product. You and I go out and we buy a Ford Fusion or a Cadillac ATS. We pay for it for several years. We use it for several years. It sits 90-some-odd percent of the time, and then we repeat that cycle again, after about 3 or 4 or 5 years. Transportation is going to be moving to a service-based industry where transportation is going to be a service as opposed to a product. And think of the transformational shift that that means. And in addition to all of that, think of all the things that we read about every day in terms of the connected vehicle, the autonomous vehicle. Think about what that does to our society. Think of what it does for public safety. Think about what that does for mobility for people who are infirmed. So this is a transformational shift, and we in Michigan and in Detroit need to own that next generation of mobility, which is going to be quite different than our current definition of mobility, which is an automotive product-based industry, and that's going to be huge.
Jeff, does it matter, even that Detroit has an identity that the rest of the country and the rest of the world can identify?
Well, it does. It matters a lot because a brand is the story you have in someone's head. And whether or not you're succeeding or not has a lot to do with how well you tell the story. What's been interesting to me is that there are three obvious things about the Detroit area that I think we're overlooking. The first is almost one-third of all trade in the United States is with Canada, and about one-third of that trade comes through this corridor. So, one, we have this enormous advantage with basically the reason the city started in the first place with the John Jacob Astor Company, right? The second is that we're surrounded by about 90% of all the surface fresh water in the United States. And as water becomes the new gold of the new gold standard of the next generation, I think it's something that we have claim to. We have to manage it in a particular way. We have particular expertise in it. Remember, we cleaned up the Great Lakes in the 1970s. But the final thing is the big one that I think Sandy was getting at, and I agree with him partially, and partially I want to caution people. One of the things that Detroit has famously been known for is power engineering. And power generation he's correct. It's absolutely the next generation. We think it's a $30 trillion industry. Here's the challenge. I have a real story about this. One of the great companies in the world wanted to relocate one of their manufacturing technology centers here in the state of Michigan. And my pitch to them, I was an advisor on their board for a number of years, my pitch to them was all these engineers were here in the greater Detroit area. Well, the engineers that were here were not the same kind of engineers that are required to make these new technologies. So you have to remember, technology and innovation moves forward, and just because you had a skill in the 1980s to make a combustion engine doesn't mean you have the skill to make an H drive. So one of the real challenges is, can we once again show our prowess and our ability to be makers in the Detroit area, not with old technology, but with radically new technology?
Sandy, yeah. As you travel around the country, and you're one of Detroit's leading economic boosters, what are you hearing people say about the city?
So the number one thing I hear about the city from potential domestic and international investors is excitement around the fact that Detroit is beginning to fix its fundamental problems. And for so long, Detroit was focused on its PR issues as opposed to its real issues. And the business community, the investor community is absolutely excited that the fundamental building blocks of a stable economy and society are being rebuilt in the city of Detroit and, frankly, the state of Michigan. Bankruptcy was something that actually we, as a business organization, was a cheerleader for. Now, that's an interesting position for a business organization to be excited about bankruptcy. But we said, listen, if Detroit's going to focus on solving its PR problem, the best way to solve its PR problem is to solve its problems to begin with.
With any growth and change comes tension, and they inevitably arise. And one of the biggest stories of that in Detroit right now is the emergence of what we see as seemingly two different cities. We've got the one in Midtown and Downtown and Corktown with new development and jobs and buzz and an influx of new talent. And then there are Detroit's neighborhoods and people who have been here all along their whole lives and may not be feeling that so-called comeback. How do we reconcile these two Detroits? Jeff, I'm going to start with you.
Well, I think there's a sequence to this. There's a development sequence, and of course, people are always going to be upset if they're not the first person in line. But a couple things that we do know. These are what are commonly referred to as creativity clusters, Silicon Valley, the Research Triangle. And what we know about the sustainable groups that work like this, they work like solar systems. Mm. There's something that holds all these disparate things together. These little things are basically feeding off large things. So if you think about for a minute, you know, the Research Triangle started with that little bit of highway between Duke and North Carolina, you know, the Mass Avenue in Boston, 401 in California. And if you're seeing it right now in Ann Arbor, think about, you know, Google's new campus that's being built on the North End. One of the things you're going to see is you need some large thing that already draws people together. Now, Detroit has a lot of those, but I don't see them yet having that kind of gravitational pull and emanating out yet. That could be General Motors. It could be Wayne State right down here. It could be a number of things, and I see all the pieces. You see the Creativity Commons, Tech Town, you see Bamboo, you see all the things that are happening down here. What you don't quite see yet is how is that all going to be pulled together? How do they synchronize with each other? Doesn't mean that they're all in bed together, but when these things work, there's these synergies that you're likely to see. The second thing that's very common is when you start looking at high growth states, in almost all high growth states, almost all the growth happens within 70 miles of its largest city. And we have this big challenge, of course, in the state of Michigan, because we've had Detroit that's been shrinking for the past 25 years. We've had the Grand Rapids area that's getting larger over the past 25 years. And really the question now is, how do these things go together? How do they sync up?
Sandy, your thoughts on this economic divide?
So I think it's the professor is exactly right. I mean, first of all, we have to be very clear that the economic vitality and success that we're seeing in downtown and midtown and some of the other neighborhoods has not reached Detroit's neighborhoods yet. And I think it really gets back to your previous guest, Alicia Merriweather, and it comes down to the issue of education. Most of the jobs that are being created in the city of Detroit, all these great new jobs, all these great new companies are coming in, are largely very high-tech, very highly skilled, very highly educated requirement jobs. And unfortunately, because of the challenges that we have had in the city of Detroit and the state of Michigan, frankly, overall, in terms of educational attainment, the issue that the professor raised earlier is absolutely true. We have some incredible assets to build upon in this city and this state, but we need the talent. We need to attract the talent, and we need to build the talent here if we're going to capitalize on those opportunities.
And I was going to, that really dovetails into what I want to ask you, Sandy, what you think in your mind is the key to Detroit's economic future.
So it's several things. You know, first of all, it is the education system. It is, fixing K through 12, no matter if it's a charter or private or a public school, we need to have good education options. Education is the ladder from, the working class to the middle class and beyond. That education ladder is broken in this nation, and particularly in the city of Detroit. And until we fix that, we will not reach the promised land, if you will, as a city or as a nation, and we need to fix that. We also need to have sustainable governmental adult supervision. We have a fantastic mayor and city council now that are working together and actually doing the heavy lift that is necessary to actually smartly manage a city with limited resources. We cannot fall back on past practices that we once had here in Detroit, and that would be very, very easy to do.
Last word for you, Jeff. What do you see?
I couldn't agree with him more. I think it's all about education. Anybody who reads my column in Inc. magazine or hears me on this program, there's no correlation between innovation, growth, and tax. In fact, the three states in the United States that have the highest realizable tax rates have infinitely more venture capital than we do. We have 3% of what they have. What the correlation is education. It's entirely the game. I want you to think about this for a minute. Cadillac moved from Detroit here to New York, a higher tax district. Why did they do that? Why did Boeing move from Seattle to Chicago, higher tax? Why did General Electric move from Connecticut to Boston? It's all about talent now. It could be anywhere. It could be on the moon. We have great schools. We have great people here in Detroit. Why not us?
And you believe this is going to come together? That's, I guess, my final thought. Do you both see this happening?
I do. I mean, the recovery that is occurring in the city and the state is real. It's tangible. And what I like about it, it is private sector led. It's not government led. It's private sector led. And also, it's not led by our traditional industry. I mean, so much of Detroit's revival has not been necessarily led by the automotives. The automotive companies have been engaged, have been key partners, but they haven't been, the big checkbooks that started this all. It's been other industry, and that's been very positive.
Sandy Barua is the president and the CEO of the Detroit Regional Chamber, and Jeff DeGraff, of course, innovation expert at the University of Michigan's Ross School of Business and our partner on The Next Idea. It was great to have you both with us today in Detroit. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm Cynthia Canty. So pleased to be doing our show today from the Charles H. Wright Museum of African American History, with it's just packed with historic treasures and engaging exhibits. So earlier today, I just had to get out and take a little tour. I'm here in the Chase Gallery with curator Petrina Chapman. It is such a pleasure to be here. Thanks to all of you and to Museum President and CEO Juanita Moore for opening the doors of this beautiful, beautiful museum to us.
And thank you for coming. We're so pleased you're here. My
let's start by talking a little about the man whose name is on the building, Charles H. Wright. Who was he, and how did his name come to be on this building?
Well, first, Dr. Wright was a physician, a gynecologist, an obstetrician, who actually has been documented almost as having delivered 7,000 babies in Detroit alone. So a great man in that right. And he also founded the museum in his office, starting the museum by collecting small items, but it was important to him to develop this museum for children, for young people, so that they would know their culture. Of course, he went on to open the building, a second building, which was right down the street on Frederick, became Frederick Douglass. It was called the Museum of African American History. And then we moved on to this institution, which is the second building, and it was built particularly for this institution, and it is 125,000 square feet. We are the largest African American museum in the country, at least right now.
It's fabulous. And exhibitions that are going on, I know that you've had this No Boundaries Aboriginal Contemporary Abstract Painting. That's been going on, and there's still a few more days for people to catch it. Tell us a little about that.
Yes. It's important that they get down right away and see this phenomenal exhibition by Aboriginals out of Australia. And the paintings are extraordinary. This is the fourth stop on the venue of six stops, so there's very short time to see it, and you may never see it again. So please, come on down.
And No Boundaries will be running through this coming Sunday. And where we're standing is Collect, the Power of Knowing. And there are some incredible pieces of everything here. Tell us about this exhibition.
This was a vision of Dr. Cleetie Taylor. Dr. Taylor is an educator, art historian who lives here in Detroit and has been working with artists for over blank years, let's say, for a very long time. And she came up with this idea, this vision that people should collect, should know their own culture. And if they collect, they should know what to do with those collections prior to their making their transitions. Mm-hmm. So these are still around for people to enjoy in years to come. And so you see about 40 different collectors in this exhibition. And each one had an opportunity to loan one piece, one that was important to them. And some of them are artists as well. And so that's what it's an eclectic collection, and it's just beautiful. And it's funny how they all came together and worked so well together.
There's furniture, there's sculpture, there's art.
Yes, there's African art, there's photography, there's everything, and everybody collects all of it.
And then coming up, opening June 2nd, In the Paint, Art and Spirit of the Games, and we're getting into the Olympic spirit with this.
We're getting into Olympic spirit. It's not specifically Olympic game exhibition, but it is about the art of playing, competition, you know, and coming together and learning about each other through games, physical games, basketball, football, all of that. But this is not about physical, it is about art, fine art. We're doing it through fine art. Many of the posters that were used, some in the Olympics and other places, to announce the games, to let people know, and they were done in most cases in this exhibition by African-American artists. So we're trying to let people know, like moms and dads, let your children become artists because there are venues for them. In many cases, we're worried that our children will become starving artists. But no, there are places that they can actually make money, and this particular exhibition will help them realize that, will help them see that.
So that is opening June 2nd in the Paint, Art and Spirit of the Games, and that will be running through the summer.
Yes.
So if someone was walking into this incredible building for the first time, Petrina, where would you send them? What's your favorite spot in this building?
Oh, I love the whole building, so that's a hard one. But I think when they walk into this building, the first thing that will impact them is our rotunda. In there, you have a wonderful space. We have the largest dome outside of Lansing in the state of Michigan. And we have what maybe they don't have. We have this echo that lets you know you've walked into a different space. It's wonderful. Sometimes choirs just come there and begin to sing. And then our major exhibition. We are the largest African-American museum, but more important is that we have the largest exhibition dedicated to the history of African-Americans. And I think that when they go through it, it's 22,000 square feet. Mm-hmm. We began at the beginning of humankind and bring you all the way up to Barack Obama. So once you get through that exhibition, you will have traveled 3.2 million years.
You have been here almost 30 years. I can tell your pride here, Petrina, is just bursting, and it should be. And again, thank you so much for sharing your love of the Charles H. Wright Museum with
us. Thank you for having me.
And we will continue with our special stateside broadcast live from Detroit. First, a little more jazz from the Marcus Elliott Quartet. You're listening to Michigan Radio. Welcome back to Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm Cynthia Canty, and we are broadcasting live from the Charles H. Wright Museum of African American History in Detroit. Wonderful audience with us today. We are so happy you are here. Well, Detroit is changing, as we have been discussing through this program. Record-setting demolitions, new development, new transit projects. They are transforming the landscape in some parts of the city. There is excitement and unease as many Detroiters see change coming their way. Michigan Radio's Sarah Swick visited one Detroit neighborhood right on the edge and brings us this report.
If real estate is about location, 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 North End has a lot going for it. It sits along Woodward Avenue in the heart of the city, just north of the New Center area. That's where the new M1 or Q-Line streetcar service will end up next year, linking New Center with downtown Detroit. That stretch is at the heart of Detroit's development boom. North End is perched just outside it at the moment, and people living there know it. Right now, it's a friendly, funky neighborhood. There's still some blight and other signs of the more troubled place this was not so long ago. On a beautiful spring day recently, I dropped by and found lots of welcoming people who were happy to talk.
Hi. I'm doing all right. How are you?
Like Anthony Buford. Once a month, he and a group from Central Detroit Christian Community Development Corporation gather in a parking lot and hand out pallets of food to folks in the neighborhood. Buford grew up here.
5 years ago, it was abandoned houses, and it looked like World War III around here. Now when you come around here, it looked like how the 70s, like how the 80s, early 80s used to be. Houses, beautiful houses, parks, fruit stores. Like, we just opened a laundromat.
Central Detroit Christian and neighborhood groups like it are a big part of the community fabric. Lisa Johannan is the executive director. She says they're trying to change North End from a place of last resort to a place where people want to live and stay. But when I ask if she has any concerns about the big-time development knocking on their door, she's frank about it.
Our demographic is still 92% African-American in this neighborhood. But yeah, we see some of that creep, and we're trying to do our best. That's why CDC is working so feverishly to try to acquire as many houses as we can so that they're not gobbled up by people who one day you're going to wake up and go, oh, my gosh, I can't afford to live here. Because our goal is really to provide decent, affordable housing for low to moderate income families. And there are forces that work against that just because of our location, so close to Woodward, so close to the future M1 rail.
Norma Heath is a longtime North End resident, and she's happy here.
But you lived here for 17 years. Do you think, has it changed?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. See, I used to stay on the other side of the bridge, and then I moved over here. It has really changed.
Yeah. But in a good way.
But a good way, yeah, and for the good. Uh-huh. And I like it.
That seems, with people that I'm just talking to, they seem pretty happy and think things are headed in a good direction. Do you have any worries, though? Any concerns?
Yes, I do. I put it out like that. You know, for the little people that have been living here all their lives, you know, what's going to happen to those people when things go skyrocketed, you know, are they going to push them out the way, you know? So that's a big concern.
Zion Penn is newer to North End. He's a friendly younger guy with an equally friendly dog. Penn says his neighbors here are like his family. They keep an eye on each other's stuff, even share food.
I lived in New York for many years, and even in New York, I never got this sense of community. But to come back home to Detroit and move into this neighborhood, and I absolutely adore what's happening in this neighborhood. I feel that if it's this awesome right now, you give it 10 years from now, and it's just going to be thriving with culture, community. You got a lot of community gardens, people walking their dogs, I love it. I love it. I'm going to buy this house.
But big investors have already started snapping up real estate around Woodward Avenue. Crane's Detroit Business recently found there's been more than $1 billion in real estate deals in the area since 2011. Many see that as a good thing and just a start. But there are some big questions like, who stands to benefit the most? And is there room for the people whose dedication to their neighborhood laid the foundation for revitalization? Or will developers just swoop in and capitalize on their years of hard work? We don't know yet, but lessons from other cities and Detroit's own troubled past tell us that people with some concerns about where this is headed aren't just being paranoid. I'm Sarah Swick, Michigan Radio News.
And here with us live is Reverend Joan Ross, as Senior Pastor for Salvation Temple Church North End and Board Chair for Storehouse of Hope. She is a community leader in the North End neighborhood. Reverend Ross, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Cynthia, for having me.
So tell us, what do you see as the main strengths of your community?
Well, certainly the strengths of the community are its people. We have a wonderful group of people. We have great assets in those people in our community. We've always been able to pull together to work on common problems and to work together collaboratively to make our community the place that it is today. I'm excited about the work that you see going on in the North End, how residents have taken responsibility and taken hold of making our community what it is today.
What are the biggest challenges your community faces?
Certainly the biggest challenge is the development that's moving in on us, not just on our community, but around our city. The challenge of the two Detroits is certainly real. It's certainly alive in all of the cities.
So what does it feel like on the ground, in the streets, in your neighborhood?
It feels like we've got to be concerned and be worried about what's happening. We're facing the push into the North End. Although it's been 52 years coming, we've had this whole problem of two Detroits for 52 years, with development constantly being in the midtown, downtown areas and a disinvestment in community. But now, all of a sudden, we see this buying up of land and the restructuring of the things that people know as community. When we see 10 years from now, it may look like a community, but it may not be the community that has the residents who have been faithful to this city, this law.
And when you hear the headlines, and as you say, what's happening in Midtown and Downtown and Corktown, I mean, does it matter? Does a new Red Wings arena make a difference to
you? Oh, yes, it does.
How so?
And what matters most is that community voice is being left out of those conversations. We are now working very hard. We have an initiative for the November ballot to get a community benefit ordinance on that ballot. It's important now that community voice be heard. We've been 52 years waiting for the trickle-down, and the trickle-down hasn't happened.
What kind of voice would you want in that? Let's talk about, for example, the Q1 or the M1 rail line, the Red Wings Arena. What would a community voice mean?
So the community benefit ordinance gives us a playing field, a level playing field, and it also brings about a fair exchange. When we hear about private corporations, private organizations coming in, they're still coming in asking for large amounts of public money, public land, and resources, but they're leaving out the voice. Yes, they're private companies, private organizations, but they're still asking for public handout, public assistance. And then if the public is putting in money, we ought to have voice in that. We ought to be at the table in those discussions, in those decisions, saying what is good and what's best for our communities.
Are residents in the North End getting the support and the services from the city that they need, or do you feel like you're going it alone? I guess I'm asking, is Detroit City Hall and its services there for people who are not Dan Gilbert and Mike Ilitch?
Well, there are city services that are beginning to come back. You know, for a long time, our community, like most of Detroit, sat in the dark. We even put in our own solar lights because we were in the dark, and we had to do something about our children standing on corners waiting for school buses and our women walking to bus lines in the mornings in the dark. So we had to do something about that. So we have taken that upon ourselves as one of the initiatives in the North End to put in solar lights of our own.
What are some of the other grassroots initiatives?
We just started the first community land trust, has started in the North End, because we're very concerned about land and about all our land being grabbed up from us. So we, in October, raised $108,000 in a GoFundMe campaign and purchased some of the homes that were in the tax foreclosure auction. That's a really big piece of land control, is very important. We've also got our first community radio station, or our only community radio station, that we're trying to get up and on air, because it's important that people have voice. So these three things, the community benefit agreement, the community land trust, community radio, those provide equity to community, and they give us voice and power and some of this back that we're losing.
What is your personal vision when you look around your home, your neighborhood, the North End, let's say 10, 20 years from now? What's your vision?
I see an investment that needs to be made in the folks that have stuck it out, the folks that are Detroit, that have stayed, to rebuild our homes, to make our community and our neighborhoods back the way they used to be, homes that we could exchange information across the fence with our neighbors. I see that we need to work on the elements of our school. We don't have a public school in our community, so we need schools and we need the education. And I see voice being provided to people that they can no longer just sit and allow these things to happen, where our money is taken, our land is taken, our resources are used, and we are left without any say in it at all. Even with the M1, we have no say in what happens around the M1. It is just happening.
And it's right there in
right
part
there.
Of your neighborhood.
Yes, ma'am.
And do you believe this vision will come true?
Oh, yes. I believe that the people of Detroit have gotten to the point that they are willing to stand up. They are willing to go to the ballot. They are willing to say, even though you're in office, you're not working in our best interest. Let's go forward together.
The Reverend Joan Ross, Senior Pastor for Salvation Temple Church North End and the Board Chair for Storehouse of Hope, providing emergency food, resource referrals, and other services for people in Detroit's North End neighborhood. Reverend Ross, we want to thank you so much
for
joining us today. It was great
to
have you with us. Well, one of the very big treats of doing stateside today at the Wright Museum has been the live music that you've been hearing from the Marcus Elliott Quartet. Marcus Elliott, I want to thank you so much for bringing your group and being with us today.
Well, thank you for having me. I'm a big fan of your show, and I'm really excited to be here.
Well, thank you. Well, you're the guy we've been hearing on sax. Tell us, who are the other members of your group?
All right. We got Michael Malice on piano, Ben Ralston on the bass, and Stephen Bagehold on the drums.
And you're all Michiganders?
Yes, we are.
How long have you been together?
This group has been together for a little over 3 years now. We play down at Cliff Bell's every Tuesday night, and so when I moved down here, I called these guys and asked if they wanted to play with me, and they were like, yeah, so we've been playing ever since.
How and when did you get hooked on jazz?
Oh.
You can't even remember, can you?
It's been, let's see, I started getting into jazz actually because my father started taking me down to a lot of clubs. I'm originally from Milford, Michigan, but all my family is originally here in Detroit. And so my dad would take me down to jazz clubs, and I started actually meeting people my own age that were playing the music. And I was like, whoa, there's actually kids that play this as well. And so I was introduced to a whole community of amazing Detroit jazz musicians. And so once I heard people my own age playing, I just jumped on it.
And I know now you teach, among other things, you teach at Troy High School. Why is teaching important, Marcus?
Teaching is important because it's really a part of the tradition of jazz music, especially here in Detroit. It's something that one of my teachers, who we just lost recently, Marcus Belgrave, he was all about teaching and all about passing down the tradition. And so as a jazz musician, that's just kind of one of the things that come along. You improvise, you compose, and you teach.
Now, you have played all over the world. I was looking on your website. I am completely blown away. Huge list of countries, Canada to Botswana to Indonesia, parts in between. How does this quintessential American art form of jazz translate abroad when you're playing?
You know, it really translates really well because jazz is American music. And as we know, America is the melting pot of all of these different cultures. And you know, in all these different cultures around the world, there's improvisation. So as an improvised art form, it's very easy to go any place and just play. You know, it really is, you know, music really is a universal language. And I got to really experience that firsthand. And I want to give a shout out to my man, Anthony Stanko, because that's the group that I do a lot of traveling with. He's an amazing trumpet player, and yeah, we've had a lot of great experiences together.
Give us a sense of a moment that is really in your heart when you were playing and you felt like you really connected across cultures with music.
I can't really think of one specific moment, but I would just say in general, you know, it's just really amazing. Sometimes you forget as a musician and as an artist just how important what it is you do is to the community. And especially when you're in different cultures and or different places where they don't really get to experience that music, live music, you know, they don't really get to experience that very often. So when they do, they're almost in tears afterwards, you know. And you don't even have to go far. I mean, you can experience that here in our own hometown. There's a, you know, there, just earlier we were talking about the Detroit Public Schools, and they've taken out so many music programs. And so even when I get a chance to come here and play for the schools, and a lot of these kids have never even heard like a live instrument before, and that's crazy. But to see them light up and to see how it really touches their soul, that's really the benefit for it for me.
And I wondered what your thoughts were on how music can play a role in Detroit's comeback.
I think it's an extremely important role. Music is such a big part of this city. Earlier, you guys were talking about just having the identity, and music is constantly, not just Motown, but the jazz scene, the techno scene, the funk scene, the
garage,
I mean,
the garage
yeah. Rock. It goes on and on and on. It's such a big part of the story of the city, and I'm just happy to kind of be a part of it during this time, and yeah.
And teaching gives the chance to make more Marcuses, because if these kids well, haven't seen live music, let's get some more yeah. musicians out there. You got to start
sure.
them young.
That's You've right. That's right. You have young. To start them young. That's so important. We have to get music and just culture in general to our youth.
I know. And important. I think about when I was a kid and I got a loaned French horn, and I
right.
played French horn with my elementary school band. But we know so many districts have had to cut that out.
Yeah.
And you think, where will tomorrow's musicians come from?
Exactly.
Well, you're going to be playing us out. Tell us what you're going to be playing.
All right. This is actually a song that I composed about an experience that I had in Cuba. This is called The Hills of Pinar del Rio.
How was it in Cuba?
Oh, it was beautiful. Amazing
really
experience.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
I bet you came back with a lot of rich musical ideas.
Oh, yeah.
Everywhere you go, you probably bring things back.
Every time I'm bringing back something, it's really amazing.
Wow. Well, Marcus heads back over to his band and treats us to this wonderful music. I just have to, again, thank from the bottom of our hearts the Charles H. Wright Museum of African American History for their wonderful hospitality in hosting us today. Their staff has been absolutely wonderful, absolutely fabulous, and we're so happy that we could be here. Also, a special thanks to all of you who took the time to be here to be with us and making it a special event. I'm Cynthia Canty. This has been a live production of Stateside on Michigan Radio. Thank you for joining us, and now the Marcus Elliott Quartet will take us out. ¶¶